explain how we can understand holography from the point of view of this tensor network, and what's special about those field theories that have holographic dual from this tensor network's point of view. So as a motivation, we all want to understand some strongly coupled quantum field theory, but we know it's very hard. But fortunately, there are certain strongly coupled quantum field theories where the original degrees freedoms are very incoherent due to strong interactions. Nevertheless, they get organized into some long-lived collective excitations. Then, in principle, we should be able to find these new variables to understand the strong coupling dynamics of the original variables. So this is the cases where duality exists, where the dual variable is weakly coupled, whereas the original variables remain strongly coupled. If this happens, then all non-trivial dynamical information about this strongly coupled field theories is encoded in this change of variable. So the goal is to find the proper variables to capture the physics. And we know in condensed matter physics at least two such examples where this is useful. The first example is so-called slave particle theory that have been extensively applied to fractionalized phases such as spin liquid phase. And then second example is holography, and they seem to be very different, but I will try to make the case that they are actually very similar and closely related to each other. So suppose I have some spin system and I want to understand some ground state which does not have symmetric breaking. Then this immediately tells us that original spin is not a very good variable to work with, because spin does not have any classical expectation value. So it's not classical variables. We expect large quantum fluctuation of spin. So maybe we should find a new variable where the quantum fluctuation is weaker so that we can have better understanding of the original spin problem. And one such approach is to introduce so-called slave particle. Namely, one can decompose this spin operator into bilinear of some parton fields. So here F is a mathematical object which carries no charge because original spin does not carry any charge, but it carries only spin quantum number. But this would carry only half the spin quantum number of this original operator because spin is made of two Fs. Okay? So let's call spin on because it carries only spin. And this is just a mathematical formal mapping from the original operator into some field, some parton fields. And one can make this mapping exact, and we can try to study the original spin model using these new variables, F variables. There's nothing wrong with that. And this mapping can be applicable, can be applied to any spin system. It's just change of variable. And formally, this mapping has many to one mapping. So many F fields map into one spin field, because if you change the phase of the spin on field, the spin operator is invariant. Therefore, there is a phase redundancy. So the existence of phase redundancy immediately tells us that the theory for this new variable should respect this redundancy. So formally, this theory has to take the form of gauge theory. Okay. At the mathematical level, this gauge field is introduced as some Lagrangian multiplier that imposes the constraint that project out on physical state that we introduce by introducing this parton phase. And another peculiar thing about this gauge theory is that because gauge field has been introduced as Lagrange multiplier, there's no bare kinetic term. Namely, bare fluctuations of this gauge field is very large. That's why these parton fields get confined into original spin operator. Okay? However, this does not necessarily mean that the spin-on cannot arise as low energy excitation in your spin system, because as you include quantum fluctuations of those spin-on field, they dress the propagator of those gauge field, and in the low energy, this gauge field become a propagating mode, and they effectively describe some collective fluctuations of those spin. Okay, so, but the fact that we can apply this decomposition to any spin model does not mean these variables are always useful. Okay? These variables are useful only when the fluctuations of this gauge field is weak, so that these new variables behave almost as free particles. If this happens, then this F field is a classical variable, essentially, and we can understand some strongly coupled physics of this original spin variable using this new variable, and all non-trivial dynamical information is encoded in this mapping. Okay, so when this happens when there are a large number of degrees of freedom, here n is some flavor associated with this spin-on. It can be the representation of spin. Instead of SU2, if you have SUN, this N can be the group rank of this flavor group, for example.
Is this N related to the original model? So the original model is, say, spin 1/2 variable?
Right.
Does this fix N for you?
So, for example, you can have SU2 spin, right? But you can generalize that to SUN, for example. So that N is like.
But the original variables, if they are fixed.
So original N is 2.
That's it.
Yeah. So whether n equal 2 is large enough is of course important question. But given that n equal 2 problem is so difficult, why don't we find first a solvable problem and then try to see if the original problem is qualitatively similar to n equal infinite problem. So when this n, the number of flavor is very large, and as I said, the gauge fluctuations become weak, and this parton field behave almost as free particles, then this gauge field no longer confines these partons into this composite object. They are essentially free, and that means these partons are deconfined. And these small fluctuations of the gauge field describe some gapless excitations of those collective excitations of spin. And those collective excitations behave just like some photon field in electromagnetism. So that's why people call it emergent gauge field. But essentially, this is some spin singlet excitations of the system. And here I said emergent internal space because in the large end limit, the spin-on field become classical variable. So, and then the phase of this spin-on field is not gauge invariant object. Nonetheless, we are forced to choose this non-gauge invariant variable to describe this weakly coupled, to go into weakly coupled degrees of freedom. And this phase space of this spin-on variable can be viewed as some internal space. And this internal space becomes a classical object in the fractionalized space, in the large end limit. On the other hand, if number of flavor is not that large, then the fluctuations of the gauge field remains very strong, so that the spin-on fields are confined, then these new variables are no longer useful because they are still very quantum. There are a lot of fluctuations for these new variables too. So what's the point of using that variable? And there is a sharp distinction between this large n and small n phases, there is some topological defects which proliferate only in this limit, where those topological defects are dynamically suppressed in this limit. And they have different internal order. So for example, in this limit, there is always some gapless excitation that is protected. And when I say it's protected, it's not from any global symmetry. It's not Goldilocks mode, or it's not by fine tuning. For generic Hamiltonian, you have some gapless mode that remains gapless without fine tuning. And this is very peculiar. Usually, if you have gapless mode, they tend to get some quantum correction and become gapped or condensed. But here, there are protected gapless modes. And there must be a reason, some dynamical reason that protect those gapless modes. And we call it quantum order. And this is a more trivial case. So quantum order.
Sorry, can you go back?
Yeah.
So can you repeat what you meant by emergent internal space? I did not understand that.
In order to introduce a weakly coupled degree freedom, you are forced to introduce non-gauge invariant field. Okay, so this field has still large quantum fluctuation. So you want to find some new variables that whose quantum fluctuation is weak.
But this, the change of variable to this before, right? We are still talking about change of variable.
Yeah, this variable. Okay. And this F, the phase of this F is not well defined. In that sense, it's not gauge invariant object. But we have to choose this kind of variable in the large limits because they are the classical variables. And therefore, the internal phase now become meaningful in some sense.
That's what you call it, emergent internal space.
Yeah, emergent of internal space. For example, in electrodynamics, we always talk about phase of electron, right? But strictly speaking, phase of electron is not well defined because it's not gauge invariant object. But the reason why we can still talk about that is because electrons are in the deconfinement phase. Essentially, it's in the large end phase. If it was in this phase, then electrons always get confined so that there is no sense of talking about phase.
Actually, how do we make the distinction between large n and small n?
Okay.
In particular also, what kind of model do you have in mind? And also, what kind of methods can you use to compute that for small n you have confinement node, one model, and so on?
So the answer depends on the space-time dimension and the gauge group. It depends on details, but perhaps the simplest example is say 3+1 dimensional case where this gauge redundancy is U1. In this case, there is a topological defect called monopole, which is the magnetic source of this U1 gauge field. And depending on whether these monopoles are proliferated or not in the vacuum, you are in different phases. But
more. If you could tell what kind of model you have in mind.
You mean the microscopic model?
Yeah.
For example, Heisenberg model on some frustrated lattice, like Kagome lattice.
Right.
And it is very likely that the ground state is a spin liquid state without symmetry breaking.
Right.
So
I guess you're referring to this recent numerics.
Right. But you can tune the model by adding some ring exchange term to stabilize the.
In principle, this is not generic, right? This is just for some particular models that you can make.
I mean, this slave particle description is not specific to any model. You can apply it to any theory and see what happens to that theory.
And right, but the thing is that, right, if you consider some, consider Heisenberg on square volumes, right?
Yeah, then.
You can apply it, but then you.
Then probably you.
Know
you
orders,
yeah,
you know
then.
It's gonna be,
yeah, then you will get. You will go into this phase. It's likely that you will go into this phase.
But you're telling that large n.
Oh, okay. So large n is only one factor. So there are other factors that determine the fate of the system, like degree of frustration, and then the band structure of this.
Okay. So this is not a generic statement. So if I take, let's say, if I consider, you know, square lattice heading in the model, there will be no distinction, right, between large and small. Because I'm just trying to understand whether you're making
that
the distinction for, you know, whether you're claiming it's generic or is it for just Kalman.
Yeah, I mean, it's generic in the sense that if you, for generic model, not specific to some model where the synons have some complete nesting, for example, if you tune your parameters in your Hamiltonian to a generic value, and then if you go to large n limit, it's likely that you will go into this deconfinement phase. But okay, so quantum order is not associated with classical order. It's not associated with global symmetry breaking. It's associated with some order in the pattern of entanglement in your ground state, which you cannot break by perturbing your Hamiltonian locally. So this is the protection. So if you have some global entanglement, no matter what you do locally, as far as it's not too drastic, you cannot break this global entanglement. That's how this kind of gapless mode can survive as a stable gapless mode. And one can use this notion to classify different phases of matter beyond the symmetry breaking scheme. So physically, in your partition function, you have to sum over all configuration, and you can associate some topology for the mapping from the space and time into the target space. Okay. And then in general, you have to sum over all topology for this mapping. But in some cases, systems spontaneously choose one topological sector. And then once system is trapped in one topological sector, it cannot get out by local fluctuation. If this happens, then we say there's some order in the topology or in some global entanglement. Okay. So let me switch gear to the holography. So suppose I have some d-dimensional field theory or gauge theory, and my partition function is given by functional integration of d-dimensional field, and the action in general depends on some sources, and these sources may depend on the position. Therefore, the partition function will be a functional of these sources. And this gauge string duality says that the same partition function can be reproduced by one higher dimensional quantum theory, where the new degree freedom in one higher dimensional space is related to the source through the boundary condition. So this J, X, Z, so X is the original space and time coordinate, and Z is this extra dimension, in this case, the coordinate associated with the scale of the theory, is the dynamical field in the bulk. And then z equals 0 is the boundary of the bulk space and time. And then at the boundary, this dynamical field is constrained by the source of this original theory. So this is a conjecture. Okay. There's no proof. There's no derivation yet. But there is very good evidence that this is likely to be true, for example, in some highly supersymmetric gauge theory. Okay, and then the question that I would like to ask is the following. First, can one derive holographic duals for general QFT? And the answer is yes, and there is a general prescription to derive holographic duals. More important question physically is this one. So suppose I have a theory suppose I derive this one higher dimensional theory from the original theory. But is this representation always useful? If it is useful, when is it useful? And what is the criterion that says that in certain limit, these new variables become classical? And is there a sharp criterion that we can use to say that these new variables become a classical variable? And the answer is yes, as I will tell you. And there's a distinct topological order associated with this. Okay? So if you have this holomorphic description, and if these new variables in one higher dimensional space is weakly fluctuating, which I can define more precisely later, then there is a emergent space, which has this one extra dimension. And then in the bulk, there is some gapless mode, whose gaplessness is not protected by any global symmetry, but it's some consequence of dynamical protection. And this means that in this kind of theory, there is an operator in the field theory whose scaling dimension is protected from acquiring anomalous scaling dimension due to interaction.
I'm trying to understand the two questions, and I suspect you're giving different meaning to, well, in the first sentence
right.
You say, can one derive holographic dual
right.
for a general dual
so
theory?
Can,
yes is yes.
Can one derive this kind of thing?
You can always make
it. Yeah, we can always change the variable.
But then on the second question?
When the theory goes into this phase.
Oh, you're right? Okay.
Yeah.
So the second question is not just whether you can derive it, but whether it's a classical.
When can I use the classical approximation?
Classical
right. And is there a precise meaning for that?
And you call that description. Can you go back to? So in the case, you call it holographic description.
Yeah, that means I change the variable, and this new variable will become classical.
So if it's not classical, you don't call it holographic.
Right, right,
okay.
Right. Okay, so this is the bottom line. So this is quite general, but I will try to explain this using a specific theory, so which is a matrix model. So let me explain. So I have some lattice. This is some Euclidean lattice that represents my d-dimensional space and time. And the basic theory's freedom that I have is n by n matrices defined on every link, ij. And I require gauge symmetry. In other words, my action is invariant under local un transformation. Then the most general action that you can think of should be made of Wilson loop, where Wilson loop is a trace of path ordered product of this link variable. So since there is no open end or closed loop, this object is invariant under this gauge transformation. And in general, action can be any function of Wilson loop. Okay? And one can expand this potential for the Wilson loop in power series. You can have one power of Wilson loop and two powers of Wilson loop, etc. And then for each terms, there is a coupling constant, J. But these coupling constants are defined in the space of a loop, because most general operators that I can turn on is defined in the space of a loop. Okay. So for n equal 1, I have this coupling constant as a function of one loop variable. For n equal 2, I have a coupling constant function of two loop variables, etc. So this is my theory, and
N
is some parameter.
So parameter.
The coupling constant. Yeah. So this the first term is like a mass term for every component of this matrices. And M square is like the mass of this bare mass of this field. Okay.
I mean, is there any motivation for this?
Yeah, motivation is that this theory includes the gauge theory, but it's much easier to study. For example, in the gauge theory, the basic degree of freedom is UN matrix, right? The unitary matrix. But here is just a full complex matrix. But you can choose some parameters in your potential such that the the fluctuations of the modulus of the matrix is gapped out, so that only remaining gapless modes are the unitary matrix. In that case, the low energy fluctuations of this model is just a UN gauge field. It's like a linear signal model. You can study XY model, or you can study some complex FIFO theory, but they are in the same university class. But this is much easier to study because there is no constraint for these matrices. Okay, so the goal is to try to construct holographic dual for this theory. But let me just illustrate the basic idea using the language that is probably familiar to people here. So first, I think this is very easy one for you, that we note that the partition function can be viewed as a trace of a contraction of d-dimensional array of tensors. And each tensor has internal lag, which is basically the dynamical degrees freedom here in this case U matrix. And it also has external lag, which is fixed, it's a coupling constant. Okay? And I have d-dimensional network of the tensor and two compute partition function I trace over all internal indices, all internal variables, or integrate out all internal variables. So the basic idea of real space RRG is that instead of integrating out these internal variables in one step, why don't we do that in a multiple step and organize the integration in the energy scale? And there's a technique introduced by Polchinski to do real space RRG locally in real space. For example, suppose I have some mass scale in my variables, like the mass n for the matrix. And then I divide my integration into two parts, where the high energy modes are the fluctuation that is governed by higher mass field. And then U low energy is the remaining fluctuations, some low energy fluctuations. And this can be done on every link on the space. Now, usually, at this stage, we integrate out the high energy field here. Then we get some effective action for the low energy field with renormalized coupling constant. But instead of doing that, what we do is to interpret this high energy field as another source for the low energy field. So there is always coupling between low energy field and high energy field. But for a given configuration of the high energy field, we have a theory for the low energy field, whose coupling depends on both J, original coupling, and then high energy field. Right? But this high energy field is not constant. They are fluctuating. They're, in that sense, the low energy field is coupled with a background of fluctuating sources. That's the viewpoint that we can take.
But you are integrating out this fluctuating sources, right?
Right. I have to integrate them out because high energy fields are dynamic.
What I mean is the original sources, they are not integrated.
These are the fixed ones.
And the other ones?
Right, but at the next level, the coupling for these guys are fluctuating. So this can be made more explicit mathematically by introducing some Lagrange auxiliary fields. So here, I can decouple the coupling between low energy field and high energy field by introducing these two variables, phi and phi star. So here, physical meaning of phi. So again, in the partition function, phi and phi stars are integrated out. So phi is the fluctuating source or coupling for the low energy field. Okay. But this fluctuating source should be determined by the original high energy field and the source, original source. So there must be a constraint that fix the relation between this U and this high energy field and fixed source. So that constraint is imposed by some Lagrangian multiplier. And here, phi star is that Lagrangian multiplier. So if you integrate out phi star, you get delta function for phi. And if you integrate out phi, then you restore the original thing. Okay? That's the picture. So at this stage, phi and phi stars are just the auxiliary field. They don't have any action. At this stage, now we integrate out this high energy field. And then you generate some non-trivial action for phi star. In general, you would expect that the action for the phi star is non-local, because if you integrate out this layer, there will be coupling between phi star here and phi star there. But here, since UH are only high energy mode, they are very massive mode. By integrating out massive mode, you generate non-locality on that decays exponentially in space. So by just pictorially or conceptually, I can associate some local action or local tensor generated out of this high energy field. So this is one step of RG. So after this step, what we get is a theory for low energy field alone, whose sources phi is now fluctuating, it's dynamical. And the fluctuation of phi is controlled by some action for phi and phi star. Okay. So basically what I did is I traded the high energy mode with fluctuating sources. And this is an exact mapping. And I can repeat these procedures many times. I start from this guy and divide this guy into low energy mode and high energy mode again, introduce another set of auxiliary field at the next layer and keep doing the same thing. And then in the end, we have this picture. So original d-dimensional partition function now can be written as contraction of d plus one dimensional array of tensors. Now note that the internal variables now, those variables that are contracted is not original u variables here. They are this fluctuating source phi and this conjugate field phi star. And here the extra dimension, as we go to, as we build this extra layer, we go to lower and lower energy scale. And this can be made continuous because I can change my mass scale infinitesimally at each step. Okay. So I introduce length scale or mass scale, and then at each step of RG, I traded the high energy fluctuations with fluctuating source. And then I have a field that is defined in d plus one dimensional space and time. Okay, so a few comments. First, this is an exact change of variable, just like the decomposition of the in the slave particle approach. This mapping itself is exact. Likewise, this mapping is exact. And formally, any d-dimensional partition function can be written as a d plus one dimensional partition function, where new variables are these fluctuating sources. Okay, and if we apply this procedure, and this procedure can be applied to any quantum field theory or any quantum many body system.
So in this construction, is there any relationship with this Westphal minimal Witten term? So usually Westphal minimal Witten term is defined in D dimension and we can extend it to D plus 1D. So and the action itself is independent of how you extend it.
Yeah, so I think this is kind of a more general version of Westphal minimal Witten term.
Uh-huh.
In the Westphal minimal term is topological, right? It does
depends
on the specifics of how you extend the boundary field to the bulk.
That's also gapless, right? So here you're talking about some gapless.
Here, the bulk action depends not only on the topology of the field configuration in the bulk, but in general, it's gapless in the bulk as well. So if we apply this prescription to the matrix model or gauge theory that I just introduced, then in the end, what I get is a field theory of closed string or a closed loop. Why do I get field theory of loop? Because, as I said, in this mapping, the dynamical variable in the bulk are couplings, right? Fluctuating couplings. But in the matrix model, the couplings are defined in the space of a loop. Therefore, in this mapping, the variables in the bulk should be defined in the space of a loop. That's why we get the field theory of loop variables instead of point-like field or point-like particle. And this is what we get. For
can you go back two steps?
Two steps.
One more. So if I look, so you make a comparison with a meta, right?
Yeah.
And I would be very concerned if this was a meta because the causal structure is not the right one in the sense that if you look at the original fluctuations that is the original sources, they would spread. If I take this picture, maybe I'm taking it too seriously, and it doesn't mean what I think it means. But I would think that if I start with a localized source on X,
okay,
it's spreading
right
a lot as I go.
Okay, so that depends on what you get in the Bulk theory. It may or may not.
Okay.
So what I think Mera is a special kind of example of this, where you keep certain, you require a certain amount of locality.
But you don't actually require a locality in the Mera. You're just constraining into a procedure
right
that includes the locality, but it doesn't mean that you are constraining the theory you are dealing with.
But, you know, so here, for any theory, you can construct this, okay? But depending on the theory, sometimes the Bulk theory can have a lot of gapless mode, in which case the theory will look very non-local, just by the fact that you have a lot of gapless mode in the Bulk. But in certain theory, many of them, most of them are gapped. So you have only finite number of gapless field in the Bulk.
These fields are already on the Bulk?
On the Bulk.
So here you construct this partition function instead of wave function, right?
This is partition function.
Yeah. So in the mirror, I think it's wave function. So
you
know, there's a CF.
Right. And I was trying to see it.
So it's not exactly the same thing, but in spirit, it's very analogous.
Okay.
So this is kind of deriving this Mera structure starting from your field theory, rather than defining your ansatz from your tensor, right? Okay, so this is the D plus one dimensional theory that is holographically dual to this UN gauge theory. So where your degree freedom phi carries two indices, so C is the loop in this original d-dimensional space, and Z is the scale. So this is a D plus one dimensional field. And your partition function is given by functional integrations of this D plus one dimensional field. And you can explicitly construct this action. Okay, so there is some Bulk action that depends on the field in this D plus one dimensional space, and there is also some boundary action.
So in such a construction, can you make sure the theory you constructed in D dimension is a local theory? It's in general can be non-local because for the simple example,
in D plus one dimension.
In D dimension, you constructed this D dimension theory as a boundary of D plus one.
Right.
Yeah. So the explicit example is that in D plus one, if it's a transcendent theory, then in D dimension, you can have this chiral lattice. But then it's the chiral lattice itself is not a local theory in D dimension.
So here,
have some restrictions that make sure this D dimensional theory is still a local?
So here you can always start from D dimensional theory.
I see.
You build up.
I see.
Yeah.
So there.
But you have.
So you make sure there's no any kind of anomaly. So for example, you don't have parallel anomaly.
Right. Yeah. But you can choose to have introduce some non-locality. Right. So basically, what the boundary action does is to impose this constraint. How this field phi behave at the boundary, at the UV boundary. So that's the role of the boundary action. And then there's a Bulk action. So this one is more interesting. So first Z is the scale in this real space RG, but it's convenient to interpret this Z as time. But just for the sake of interpretation, then I can view this phi and phi star as some coherent field for the annihilation and creation operator for the loop object. And then the remaining term in the action can be viewed as a Hamiltonian. And this is a quantum operator defined in the loop space. And this operator is kind of the coarse-graining operator. It's a quantum operator that evolve the state along the along the scale direction.
Sorry, which one is this?
The remaining term in the action. So you know the action can be written as this very phase term plus Hamiltonian. So the remaining term here, the three terms are the Hamiltonian, basically. So this first term says that phi and phi stars are creation and annihilation operator. And then the remaining terms are the Hamiltonian. So Hamiltonian has the three terms. So here A daggers are just operator for phi and phi star. So the first term in the Hamiltonian is like the mass term. It's a quadratic term and it's diagonal in the loop space. And it's like a mass of the loop. And alpha is just a constant. It's the speed of RG that you can choose to any positive value that you want. And L of C is the length of the loop. So here the first term says that mass of the loop is proportional to the length. So it's like a tension of the loop. And then the remaining two terms describes the interaction between these loops. And there can be two interactions. First, if you have a large loop like this, made of two small pieces like C1 and C2, then this large loop can split into two small loops like C1 and C2. The inverse is also possible. If you have two small loops like C1 and C2, like this, and if they share a link like this, then they can join into a large loop.
Sorry, what does the indexes I and j also
for the loops mean? Oh, this indices?
Yeah.
Oh, this just means that this C1 and C2 is linked through some specific link ij. And this f is a form factor, which is 1 only when C1 and C2 can be joined through one link. Otherwise, it's 0.
So, do you have branching in this structure construction?
Branching is not allowed for UN.
It's not allowed.
Yeah, it's yeah. Because the flux is conserved.
In this loop, like this Wilson loop, I mean, the loop in your construction, can you interpret it as like Wilson loop in the gauge theory?
Yeah, the origin of this loop is the Wilson loop. So you, in the original theory, you turn on sources like this, right?
Uh-huh.
And these sources are the that means you turn on Wilson loop operators at the original theory, and this is fixed at the boundary, but it becomes dynamical as you go to infrared, and it becomes a fluctuating object. Okay, and another important point is that we have n squared degrees freedom because we are dealing with n by n matrix. Therefore, action should be proportional to n squared. And here, the loop variables are gauge invariant. That means the action should be proportional to n squared explicitly. Therefore, if n is large, the fluctuations of this loop field will be small. So there will be some energy. So some energy landscape. The action for the loop field will depend on the configuration of the loop field in D plus one dimensional space, and there will be some minimum energy configuration, some saddle point. And in the larger limit, this potential is very steep. Therefore, the fluctuations of this loop field will become very small. That means, in order to compute the partition function, you don't need to trace over all internal fields. You don't have to integrate. Instead, you just replace with one configuration at each bound, which is, of course, determined by solving equation motion in the quark. So this is the saddle point approximation. The non-trivial thing is that although you can do this saddle point approximation in this loop space, in the original variable, it's still very strongly coupled theory. So U variables are still very quantum. So you cannot do perturbative calculation. Nonetheless, by changing this variable, changing variable into this loop variable, you can do the saddle point approximation. The price you have to pay is that you have to introduce one higher dimensional space. So the next important question is, when can we do the saddle point approximation? Okay. when can we systematically improve the exact partition function starting from the saddle point solution and by introducing some perturbative one-way correction. Okay. This we can do when we can ignore some non-perturbative fluctuation. So you have some landscape, and there are small perturbative fluctuations, but also there are some non-perturbative fluctuation coming from some quantum tunneling, etc. If we cannot ignore those non-perturbative quantum tunneling, then we cannot use the saddle point configuration, saddle point approximation. But if we can ignore non-perturbative fluctuation, then we are basically stuck in one configuration here. And then we can include small fluctuations. And by doing this, we can compute our partition function to any accuracy we want. But there's a catch. When we say the system is trapped in one sector, it means there's some kind of non-trivial order. In the same sense that systems choose some particular topological sector, because there are many probably equivalent vacua in the energy landscape, and there will be some non-trivial quantum tunneling in principle. But those quantum tunnelings are dynamically suppressed. So it's like that. Suppose you compute this whole partition function using Monte Carlo, right? So you update your variables at each link using some scheme, right? And you start from one particular topology of this configuration. And you ask whether system can dynamically escape that topology and go into another topological configuration. Okay, if it cannot escape that topological sector, then I'm saying there is a topological order and some non-trivial quantum order. And there is some protected quantity associated with that selection. So this is essentially the physical content of non-trivial quantum order. And then, of course, in order to do that, we had to introduce this one higher dimensional space. Okay. That's the price we pay, but we can do the saddle point approximation. So in the remaining of my talk, let me just try to make this question more precise. So by introducing this one higher dimensional field, I end up introducing a lot of redundancy, not surprisingly, right? Because when you write spin operator into two spin on field, I have U1 redundancy, but I kind of have infinite copy of one operator at each scale. So there's a lot of gauge redundancy. And then the physical origin of the gauge redundancy is the following. So in field theory, your action is written as product of source and operator, right? J times O, that's what enters into the action. And we know that the relative phase between source and operator is ill-defined. The action is invariant under simultaneous rotation of phase of source and operator. Of course, this symmetry is not very useful in usual field theory because source is fixed. Source is not a dynamical variable. But in this holographic description, these sources are dynamical. So they are fluctuating. Therefore, this symmetry is now important. And this is the reason why we have gauge redundancy. And the consequence of having this gauge redundancy is that the action, the format of action is very constrained. For example, in the Hamiltonian that I showed you here, there is a quadratic mass term and there's some cubic interaction term. But there's no hopping term for the loop field. For example, I don't have C dagger, so AC dagger and AC prime. There's no term that tells loop can hop from one configuration to another configuration. Okay. This is because I can change the phase of the loop field independently along each link. So such non-local term, non-local hopping term is not allowed in this Hamiltonian. So loops can join and split on site, and they have the tension without moving, but loop itself cannot move. So this is a strange kind of Hamiltonian. So you may say, then probably this loop object is always localized in space. They will not be able to propagate in space because there's no kinetic term. However, it's not always true, because when you find a saddle point, at the saddle point, the loop field generically have some non-zero expectation value. So if loop field has non-zero expectation value, and you look at small fluctuation around that saddle point configuration, then now these small fluctuations have kinetic term, because you know you have cubic term and you replace one of them with the expectation value, then you immediately have the quadratic hopping term. Therefore, the strength of the hopping of the loop field is determined by the loop field itself. Okay? In some sense, loops are propagating on loops. Okay? If there is only when there is some classical expectation value of the loop field, the small fluctuations of loop field have a well-defined kinetic. And then another interesting point is that this loop field is complex field, so it has magnitude and phase. So when you have phase, it means that when loop hop from configuration C prime, say into C plus C prime, by adding small piece C, so it's like this loop C prime become C plus C prime by adding some area determined by C. When this loop hop, it acquires a phase coming from the complex field of the loop field itself. And this is like the Betti phase or the geometric phase. So when point light particle move in the presence of external magnetic field, it pick up some geometric phase, right? Here, what is moving is not point light particle, it's a linear object. Therefore, we need a gauge field, which is not one form gauge field, but two form gauge field, because this linear object sweeps through some area, not line. So we need to integrate some area in order to compute the phase. That's why we need to have two-form gauge field. Okay, and this two-form gauge field is dynamical because this two-form gauge field comes from dynamical loop field itself. So in the end, the theory, the loop field is coupled with some emergent two-form gauge field. And like the case in slave particle theory, this two-form gauge field does not have any bare kinetic term. It is not propagating mode. But once you integrate out some high energy fluctuations of the theory, some massive mode of the theory, it generates some non-trivial action. And you can explicitly check that by integrating out those high energy fluctuations, the gauge coupling for the two-form gauge field is minimalized to a finite value. And since you have large number of fields in the large limit, they tend to screen this two-form gauge field, and gauge coupling become weak in the large limit. That's why renormalized gauge coupling become order of 1 over n squared in the large limit. So when n is sufficiently large, you can expect that the fluctuations of this gauge field is weak. Then that means we can ignore the fluctuations of this condensate. That means the condensate of the loop field provides well-defined classical background on which small fluctuations of a loop field can propagate rather freely. Okay? And one can make this more precise because this two-form gauge field is a compact gauge field, namely 0 and 2 pi should be identified. So it's it has non-trivial topology. That means we can have some winding configuration. So phase can wind in space and time. So that means we have some vortex-like object. And because it's a two-form gauge field, the core of the vortex is not just line. It depends on the space and time dimension. The dimension of this core is d minus 3 dimensional in d plus 1 dimensional bulk. And in the d plus 1 dimensional space, the transverse direction of this defect is a four dimension, and you can think of some S3 around the defect, and then the magnetic flux of the two-form gauge field is non-zero around this S3. So it's like a basically vortex. And in principle, in your partition function or in your tensor network, you have to sum over all configuration with or without this kind of vortex. With one vortex, many vortex, small vortex, and large vortex. But in the large limit, the probability to have large vortex will be suppressed because the tension of this vortex is proportional to n squared. So it's, in the large limit, it's very hard to have large vortex. So there's a sharp division depending on n. So if n is sufficiently large, then this vortex have large tension. So even though you can have small vortex, you cannot have large vortex. So as you go to longer and longer distance scale, the typical size of vortex looks smaller and smaller. Namely, the fugacity or density of this vortex goes to zero in the infrared limit. In that limit, there is no non-perturbative fluctuation. We can basically ignore those non-perturbative fluctuations. And this is the case where we can ignore this non-perturbative fluctuation in the energy landscape. And system gets stuck in one topological sector. Right? In this case, the two-form gauge field arises as a precise massless mode in the bulk. And the reason why this mode is massless is not due to any global symmetry. It's not protected by fine-tuning or symmetry. It's an emergent one. It's exactly how the emergent gauge field remains massless without fine-tuning in the spin-liquid phase. And that's what's behind the non-trivial quantum model. So if this happens, then there must exist an operator in your boundary theory that is dual to this massless field whose scaling dimension is protected. So in this holography, the scaling dimension of an operator is related to the mass of the field in the bulk. Therefore, if you have a protection for the mass in the bulk field, you have a protection for the scaling dimension of an operator. And usually, when you see protection in the scaling dimension, you would naively associate with some global symmetry, right? If you have some conserved charge, that will give you some protection for the scaling dimension. But this operator is not that kind of conserved charge. That's why we say there's a non-trivial quantum order, when we can ignore this non-perturbative fluctuation. And this happens only when n is sufficiently large. On the other hand, if n is small, then the bare tension of this topological defect is small, so that quantum fluctuation can renormalize the tension to a negative value, then this size of the defect becomes infinite. So that means your space and time is filled with this vortices. That means in your tensor network, you have to include all non-perturbative configuration. And system can very easily escape from one local minima to another local minima that are very far from each other. So you have to include all non-trivial configuration in your sum. Okay. Then you cannot use this saddle point approximation, and there will be no such protection. OK, so that's the bottom line. So where can we apply this? So let me just show you a proposed phase diagram for SUN gauge theory. So for pure gauge theory, in dimension 4 or smaller than 4, the theory is always in the confinement phase, always in the gap phase. So it's not very interesting. The interesting thing begins to happen for pure gauge theory in dimension 5 or greater than 5. In this case, you expect to have some kind of phase transition as a function of coupling constant. Okay? So this is the strong coupling limit. And this is weak coupling limit. And this n is the size of the gauge, rank of the gauge group. And depending on how large n is, the critical points are completely different. For large n, for n greater than certain critical value, we have this suppressed topological defect in this one higher dimensional description. And we have some protected operator. And this is what I call holographic critical point. In this case, we can use the saddle point approximation, and we can use add small fluctuation. Whereas if n is small, then this vortices is proliferate in space and time. Then we cannot use saddle point approximation, and we don't have such protection. And this is what I call non-holographic critical state. So in summary, there is a general prescription that allows us to map a d-dimensional quantum field theory into one higher dimensional quantum theory. And the degree of freedom in one higher dimensional space is this fluctuating sources. And this can be always done. However, this mapping is not always useful. This is useful only when this new degree of freedom in the bulk become almost classical. And there is a precise sense of saying classical. This happens when you can ignore non-perturbative fluctuations for this new variable. And when we can ignore those non-perturbative fluctuations, you have well-defined space in the bulk. In this sense, you have emergent space. And you have some protected gapless excitation, which is related to the presence of some operator whose scaling dimension is protected. OK, so I will stop here.
Time for questions.
So in principle, when you're constructing this theory, in D dimension, you have quantum order, right? When you construct this theory, the quantum order is describe this D dimensional gated matrix model, right?
So quantum order is in D dimensional?
Yeah, describe this D dimensional system.
Yeah, so manifestation of quantum order in D dimension is that you have an operator whose scaling dimension is protected for no reason.
But in principle, this D plus one dimensional theory also have a quantum order.
So it's the same quantum order, but manifestation is different. In D plus one dimensional description, you have gapless mode. It's like emergent gauge field.
Yeah.
But for the D dimensional sense, that means you have an operator whose scaling dimension is immune to quantum correction, even though that operator has nothing to do with global symmetry.
So I have a question. So this model that you were describing, the motivation was what was a signal model type of thing?
For the gauge theory, yeah.
So is there any lattice model where this might be a good approximation?
So this is a lattice model.
Right, but sorry, not lattice model.
Conventional system.
Where that would be.
Yeah, I don't know now, but that's the. So I think the good news is that n doesn't have to be infinite. And we don't know what the nc should be.
But that was in five dimensions.
Right, but if you have some fermions or some gapless matter, then you can have critical phase even in lower dimension.
If
you include matter. But this is just for the gauge theory alone. So since n doesn't have to be infinite, there is a chance, non-zero chance, of realizing holographic phase in real system. But,
and so if we go back to the Kragon-Elastic anti-Karamanian two dimensions,
right.
And now that's a still negative.
Right.
But that's a C2. So that determines the
right. But there are some other candidates which have which is gapless spin liquid, like this spin half on triangular lattice. And there's a very good experimental evidence that it's some kind of gapless spin liquid.
Gapless spin liquid.
Right.
That could be a possible candidate of the type of orders you are describing here.
In the first part of my talk. That has non-trivial quantum order associated with this fractionalization, emergence of internal space. So this is different kind of quantum order.
It's a different.
Yeah. So we need new ingredients for this to happen, and we don't know. So interesting open question is, of course, when does this happen? And another interesting question is, what is the manifestation of this quantum order? I just told you that there's an operator whose scaling dimension is protected. What else? Is there some particular physical properties that is specific to this kind of holographic phases? Yeah.
Okay, so more questions?
So for the d-dimensional theory, you constructed a conformative theory or?
It can be anything.
It can be anything?
Yeah, so whether you are at the conformal fixed point or not will determine by the set point solution of your loop equation. So you have, you solve some set point, and then this field phi will have radial dependence. And depending on the radial dependence, you can decide, you can determine whether the field is at the critical point or not. So if you are at the critical point, then there will be some scaling symmetry, which will show up in the form of the saddle point solutions. But if you are away from the critical point, so in general, if you are away from the critical point, then loop field will have some crossover behavior. Like this, along the z direction, the loop field has some non-trivial profile. So it crossover from one configuration to another configuration. So this is a typical behavior when the system is gapped. When system is gapped, then you have only finite slack along the z direction, in which this bulk distribution can propagate. On the other hand, if you have gapless phase, then this slack can be extended to infinity.
I see. So when you arrive at a critical system, the scaling dimension, do you know any like model can be realized in kind of matter system? Like, can you explain how the scaling dimension the same as the like IC model in 3D?
Right. So I don't know about the realization in condensed matter system, but the closest model is this UN gauge theory.
I see. So you need this larger energy.
Yeah, but n can be in principle finite, right? So, for example, in the fractionalized phase, we have similar picture, right? This is